This is Audible.
Biggles was whistling softly as he walked into the breakfast room of his flat in Mount Street, but broke off as he reached for a bulky package with Canadian stamps lying beside his plate. Across the top was printed in block letters, "Confidential. If away, please forward." "What's Wilkes doing in Canada, I wonder?" murmured Algy from the other side of the table. Biggles glanced up. "Been doing a bit of Sherlock Holmes stuff with my correspondence, eh? Well, as I happen to know Wilkes' fist and am able to recognise a Canadian stamp when I see one, I put two and two together," replied Algy casually. "Who's Wilkes?" Ginger asked Algy. He had finished his breakfast and was sitting by the fire. "Wilkes, or rather Captain Wilkinson, was a flight commander in 187 Squadron in France," answered Algy. "He was an officer in the Bolivian Air Force when we last saw him. I wonder what sent him up north." Biggles read the letter to the end before laying it on the table beside him. "Poor old Wilkes is in a jam," he said quietly. "What's the trouble?" asked Algy. Biggles picked up the letter again. "Listen to this. The letter's headed Arctic Airways, Fort Beaver, Canada. My dear Biggles, as you probably remember, letter writing is not in my line, so you no doubt guessed before you opened this that things must be pretty sticky. Believe me, they're all that, and more. Before I start my story, I may as well say that the odds seem to be against my being alive by the time you get this. If I just disappear, or get wiped out in what looks like a genuine crash, find a fellow named Mac Bain, Brindle Jake, he is called around these parts, and hand him a bunch of slugs from me, as a last service from an old pal. By gosh, things must be pretty grim for old Wilkes to write in that strain," broke in Algy. "Grim is the right word for it," said Biggles shortly. "But don't interrupt. Just listen to this. You remember that I was in Bolivia a few years ago. Well, there was a change of government, and as I didn't like the new one, or maybe the new one didn't like me, I packed my valise, headed north, and ultimately drifted into Canada. One day I struck lucky and got a charter job flying a mining engineer up to some new goldfields for an outfit called the Moose Creek Goldfields Corporation. You may have heard of the last place on Earth. Well, I can tell you where it is. Moose Creek. It's well inside the Arctic Circle, though why they call it Moose Creek, I don't know, for no moose in its right mind would go within 100 miles of the perishing place. But that's by the way. Having got the lowdown about these goldfields, I have one of my rare inspirations." "Oh, that's old Wilkes for you," said Algy. "Moose Creek is 800 miles north of the nearest railhead, and the journey, made by canoe in summer and dog sled during the freeze-up, takes about 6 weeks, heavy going. It struck me that since there was certain to be a fair amount of traffic to and from the goldfields, an airline might be worked up into a paying proposition. In an aircraft, the journey could be done in a day instead of 6 weeks. To cut a long story short, I put all my savings into the venture, opening up my own landing field at Fort Beaver, which is the railhead. I called it Arctic Airways. I got into the money, and with my profits bought a second machine. Then, listen to this. Out of the blue, another fellow jumped my claim. The same Brindle Jake that I've already mentioned. It seemed a bit thick after all I'd been through, but I figured that there ought to be enough money in the game for the two of us. However, Brindle had his own ideas about that. He decided that two in the game was one too many, and he wasn't going to be the one to go. From that moment I learned that the gloves were off. There is only one possible landing ground within 50 miles of Fort Beaver, and that's mine. I bought the land off a fellow named Angus Sterling, who had decided that he preferred prospecting for gold to farming. I paid him cash, whereupon he headed north with his gear, and hasn't been seen since. I cleared the ground, put up a shed, and the land became Fort Beaver Landing Field. There was never any question about the title of the land until, one day, two Weinkel 12 transport planes landed, and out stepped Brindle Jake and his two pilots, Joe Sarton, a tall chap, good-looking in a rugged sort of way, and Tex Ferroni, a slim, dark little fellow. McBain himself is a big, broad-shouldered bloke with odd patches of grey in his hair and beard. That's how he gets his nickname, I'm told. A French-Canadian named Jean Chicot trails after him like a dog, and I reckon he's McBain's bodyguard. Pretty motley crew, put in Algy. Biggles read on. You can guess my surprise when McBain calmly told me to clear off the land. I can't go into details now, but for the first time I learned that there was some doubt as to the title of the land I'd bought off Stirling. For some extraordinary reason, there seems to be no record of his having paid the government for it. Angus Stirling told me that he got the land under a settler's grant, but the fact remains he didn't give the transfer to me. However, if I don't own the land, neither does Brindle, although he tries to bluff me he does. McBain built some sheds and started operating to Moose Creek right away. I flew up and saw the traffic manager of the Goldfields Company, a decent little fellow named Canwell, and lodged a complaint, but it didn't get me very far. Canwell's only concerned with getting his stuff to the railhead, and he doesn't care two hoots who takes it, as long as it goes. He as good as told me that in this country it's up to a fellow to work out his own salvation, so that was that. I got my first idea of Brindle's methods when a day or two later, one of my machines shed its wing just after takeoff. Yet I'd stake my life that that machine was airworthy. Brindle or one of his men tampered with it, I'm certain. But of course I can't prove anything. The pilot was killed. I bought another machine and hired another pilot. 2 days later, the new machine went up in flames during the night, and my new pilot packed up and left. I've no money to buy another machine, and the one I have left is a Rockheed freighter, which I fly myself. I sleep in it with a gun in my hand, but I can't stand the strain much longer. I've nearly been killed 2 or 3 times by accident. Brindle wants the aerodrome, but I've told him he'll only get it over my dead body, and that isn't bluff. The fact is, old lad, it goes against the grain to be run out of the territory by a low-down grafter. I'm fighting a lone hand. I'm in this up to the neck, and I'm going to see it through to the last turn of the prop. It isn't just money that matters now. I won't be jumped out by a crooked skunk. So if you want a spot of real flying, flying with the lid off, step right across and give me a hand. We did a job or two together in the old days. Let's do one more. All the best to Algy. Remember that first Hun he shot down? The laugh was certainly on you that time. Yours ever, Wilkes. Biggle's face was set in hard lines as he tossed the letter on the table. How long ago is it posted? Asked Algy. 9 days. Anything could have happened in that time. What are you going to do? Put in Ginger. That remains to be seen, replied Biggles curtly. For the moment, we're going to Fort Beaver as fast as we can get there. Algy, ring up and find out when the next boat sails. Ginger, pass me that directory. I'll send a few cables. We shall want a machine waiting for us when we land, with the props ticking over. Get your bags packed, everybody, and put in plenty of woolen kit. I've never been to Canada, but I seem to have heard that the winters there are inclined to be chilly. Then, let's go and see if we can warm things up, murmured Algy. Exactly 16 days after Wilkes's SOS had been received in London, a blue-winged Jupiter airliner circled low over the cluster of log huts which comprised Fort Beaver. Biggle sat at the controls, Algy beside him, with Ginger braced in the narrow corridor that connected the pilot's control cabin with what normally would have been the main passenger saloon. Behind, amongst the luggage in the rear compartment, sat Flight Sergeant Smith, Biggle's old fitter and share of many adventures. They all wore heavy flying kit with the fur outside, for although it was not yet winter, it was already cold, and the annual freeze-up could be expected in the near future. Biggles regarded the landing ground dispassionately as he throttled back and prepared to glide in. "I never saw a more desolate-looking spot in all my life," commented Algy. "What do you expect to find, concrete runways?" inquired Biggles sarcastically. "Anyway, is that old Wilkes I can see, mending his hut?" Algy peered through the side window. "Yeah, that fellow's too tall for Wilkes," he declared. "And he seems to be tearing the place down, not mending it." Biggles glanced across quickly. "The dickens he does. That doesn't look too good." Nothing more was said, and a minute later the wheels of the big machine were trundling over the rough surface of the landing ground, scored in 100 places with tire tracks. Moving slowly and majestically, the Jupiter roared up to where a little group of men stood staring at them from in front of a rough but stoutly built hangar, roofed with corrugated iron. "Funny. I don't see Wilkes," murmured Algy. "Maybe he's in the air." "Maybe," replied Biggles. "This is his shed, but there's his company's name board leaning against the wall. Looks as if it's just been taken down. I don't like the look of things, so we'd better leave the engines running in case we want to go up again in a hurry. Tell Smith to come here and take over and keep an eye on us. Let's get out." As the three airmen stepped down from the saloon door, leaving Smith in the control cabin with the engines idling, 4 men walked to meet them. A fifth, obviously an Indian, remained standing near the hangar. One of the four, a little ahead of the others and clearly the leader, was a tall, burly man whose bristling square-cut beard was curiously streaked with grey. He wore a fur cap with flaps hanging loosely over his ears, a check-patterned lumber shirt, and dark corduroy trousers tucked into half-Wellington boots. A broad belt, with cartridge pouches thrust through loops, was buckled tightly round his waist. The man who walked close behind him was an entirely different type, although he was dressed in much the same fashion. Slight in build, his delicate features might have passed for those of a woman, but for a wisp of black moustache that decorated his upper lip. The fur jacket he wore was thrown open, revealing a beautifully worked Indian belt, through which was thrust a large Bowie knife. Two or three paces behind strolled two other men, their hands thrust carelessly into their trouser pockets. One was a fresh-complexioned man of perhaps 35 years of age, with a fair moustache. His companion was younger, and as swarthy as the other was fair. Remembering the descriptions in Wilkes's letter, Biggles could have named them all. The big man was obviously Brindle McBain. The man who walked close behind him like a dog was Jean Chicot. The other two were the pilots, Joe Sarton, the fair man, and Tex Ferroni, the slim, dark little fellow. Wilkes's descriptions had been brief but singularly apt, thought Biggles, as he walked slowly to meet them, at the same time drawing off his gauntlets. An atmosphere of desertion, almost of desolation, hung over the place. McBain was the first to speak.
$10, stranger.
Biggles raised his eyebrows in surprise. What for?
Landing fee.
Oh, are you the authorized collector for Arctic Airways?
McBain's eyes rested broodingly on Biggles' slight frame.
No, I'm collecting for myself.
I see, and who might you be?
McBain's the name.
Ah, mine's Bigglesworth. But aren't you making a mistake, Mr. McBain? This field belongs to Arctic Airways.
Yeah? Well, you're making the mistake. Belongs to me, grated McBain.
Whatever gave you that idea? Inquired Biggles. And nodding curtly, he moved towards what was obviously Arctic Airways' reception office. For a moment it looked as though McBain would intercept him, for he took a pace forward, clenching and unclenching his hands. But then his companion said something to him that the others could not catch, and he stopped, scowling. Algy and Ginger followed Biggles into the office. There was nobody there, although by this time they did not expect to find anyone. Everything was in confusion. Files and papers were strewn everywhere. Algy's face was grim as he looked around.
"I don't like the look of this," he said quietly. "I'm afraid we've come too late."
Before Biggles could answer, there was a whip-like crack. Several splinters flew across the room, one striking Biggles on the cheek and drawing blood.
"That was a shot," snapped Algy, then darted after Biggles, who had already flung open the door and was striding white-faced towards McBain and his companions. The effeminate-looking man, Jean Chicot, was sitting on a chock, smiling, a small automatic in his hands. Biggles went straight up to him.
"Did you fire that shot?"
"I cleaned my gun. So he go off. These accidents come sometimes, yes?"
Biggles did not answer. His fist flew out in a vicious uppercut. Every scrap of the pent-up anger that was in him went behind that blow. Chicot went straight over backwards and crashed across the concrete apron. He twisted for a moment and then lay still. Biggles' face was white, and his lips were set in a straight line as he looked down at him.
"Keep your hands away from your belt, McBain," snapped Algy.
Seeing what was coming, he had whipped out his automatic the instant Biggles struck the blow. Biggles looked round.
"Plug him if he moves, Algy," he said grimly.
"If this gang of crooks wants it hot, by thunder they can have it."
"Say, what's going on?"
Biggles spun round and saw that a newcomer had arrived on the scene. It was a constable of the Northwest Mounted Police.
"What's going on?" said the constable again.
"Nothing to speak of," replied Biggles. "My friends and I just arrived by air. For some reason best known to himself, McBain tried to scare us off by getting his playmate to pull a gun on us.
So I had hit him.
The constable regarded Biggles thoughtfully.
What are you doing in this out-of-the-way place, anyway?
I'm putting money into Arctic Airways, which belongs to a friend of mine, Wilkinson. I want to know where he is, and I reckon McBain knows.
The constable turned to McBain.
Where's Wilkinson?
Search me, Delaney.
Well, when did you last see him?
4 days back. He was taken off, headed north for Moose Creek, I guess.
And he hasn't come back?
Well, I ain't looked for him.
You had a good look at the inside of his office, at any rate, put in Biggles coldly.
McBain looked at Biggles evilly, then turned to the constable.
Well, what are you going to do about it? He inquired. I've got something else to do besides standing here gassing.
So have I, returned the constable. You ought to have reported Wilkinson missing, McBain. I shall have to ask anyone going north to look out for him.
Don't worry, Constable, I'll do that, said Biggles quickly. I'm going to look for him right now.
Biggles turned towards the Jupiter.
Come on, you fellows, he went on quietly to the others, taking no further notice of Delaney or McBain.
Wilkes must be down somewhere between here and Moose Creek. We've got nearly 4 hours of daylight left, so the sooner we start looking for him, the better. Within 5 minutes, the Jupiter was in the air again, headed northwards, with Algy watching the ground on the starboard side and Ginger on the other. For a long time, they flew over almost continuous forests of fir, with great outcrops of grey rock thrusting upwards like spurs. Then the country started to rise, and the Jupiter was soon skimming over the treetops. Biggles eased the stick back and climbed slowly to a safer height. At the end of an hour, the forest had become broken into isolated groups of wind-twisted trees, and shortly afterwards even these failed to appear, giving way to a dismal panorama of gaunt rock.
If Wilkes had to go down and land on that stuff, I should say he hadn't a hope.
I shouldn't care to have to put a machine down on that... Hello? What's that, dead ahead? It looks like something on the ground. Is it... By heaven, it is. It's a machine. There's somebody beside it. Look, he's waving.
Must be Wilkes, declared Biggles.
Nobody else would be flying up here. Give him a wave.
With Algy hanging out of the window with an arm outstretched, the Jupiter dropped lower, until at last it was circling in a steep bank, not more than 50 feet above the other machine. They could see the man on the ground, hobbling away from the stationary machine, from time to time stopping to pick up a boulder and throw it aside.
He's clearing a runway for us, declared Algy.
So I see, answered Biggles with a worried frown. I don't relish the thought of getting down on it all the same.
Biggles turned the machine slowly until it was in line with the runway. Then he allowed it to sink slowly towards it. Flattening out a few inches above the ground, he held the stick firmly, holding the machine off as long as he dared. The Jupiter vibrated from nose to tail skid as her wheels rumbled over the uneven ground, but they stood up to the strain, and the machine finally came to rest about 200 yards from the lone figure, which at once began hurrying towards them. There was no longer any doubt about who it was.
"Biggles, by all that's wonderful!" cried Wilkes enthusiastically.
"Well, might you say, by all that's wonderful," grinned Biggles, as he shook hands with his old war comrade.
"Oh, the dickens, did you know where I was?" demanded Wilkes.
"Just a minute, old boy. Let's take one thing at a time," suggested Biggles. "I'll tell my story first. We've been to Fort Beaver. Landed there at about lunchtime today. We found McBain, and I might tell you, he and I had a few sharp words. Constable Delaney blew in while the argument was in progress, and McBain admitted that you'd flown off and hadn't come back. So we came along to pick up the pieces. What happened to you?"
Wilkes's smile faded as he told his story. He spoke bitterly.
"Somebody was kind enough to put a handful of loose cotton waste in my second tank, and it choked the petrol leads. Engines packed up, and I had to come down, but I had enough juice in my gravity tank to enable me to reach this place. I was lucky to make it."
"The cotton waste was McBain's work?" asked Biggles.
"Well, of course."
While they'd been speaking, they had been moving slowly towards Wilkes's machine.
"Did you knock your leg when you came down?" asked Biggles,
noting that Wilkes was limping.
"Well, I hit my knee a crack against the dashboard when we tipped up," returned Wilkes briefly.
"Machine damaged?"
"Busted tire and a bent prop. I was running some spare machine parts up to Moose Creek. They were wanted urgently, so they'll probably refuse to give me any future work." I've let them down once or twice already. No fault of my own, you can be sure.
Biggles bit his lip thoughtfully. It's too late to get the stuff up to them today, he said slowly.
But I think this is our best plan. We'll put all your cargo into my machine and fly it back to Fort Beaver. Tomorrow, Ginger and I will take it to Moose Creek. Smith and Algy had better stay here and get to work on your machine. There's nothing you can't fix up, is there, Smith?
Oh, I don't think so, sir.
Good. Algy, as soon as the machine is ready, fly her back to Fort Beaver. I'll fly low of you tomorrow on my way to Moose Creek. But I'll only land if you signal me to do so. Come on, then, let's get to work. We've no time to waste.
It took them, all working hard, about half an hour to transfer the freight from the damaged machine to the Jupiter. And once this was done, Biggles lost no time in getting off, for the sun was already low over the western hills. In a few minutes, the Jupiter was roaring back over her tracks. In spite of the fact that Biggles flew on full throttle nearly all the way, it was practically dark when the scattered lights of Fort Beaver came into sight. Suddenly, Biggles stared ahead through the windscreen. "Are those landing flares on the aerodrome, or am I dreaming?" he jerked out.
"The flares," declared a surprised Wilkes. "Well, I've never known McBain do that before."
Biggles said nothing, but a curious expression came over his face as he stared intently into the gloom. A moment or two later, he cut the engines and glided down towards the lights, only to open up again an instant later and roar up into the darkening sky.
"McBain must take me for a fool," he snarled savagely.
"Why?"
"To fall into such an elementary trap as the one he set. Those lights are in the wrong place. Had I landed up the line, I should have bashed straight into our hangar. Ginger, drop a signal flare and let's have a look at things. I'd rather trust my own eyes than McBain's flares. Cunning hound."
The signal light burst below the Jupiter, flooding the earth with its brilliant glare, and the trap was exposed to view. Biggles made no further remarks, but concentrated his attention on bringing the Jupiter down safely. Taxiing swiftly up to the shed, he opened the cabin door and jumped down. Not a soul was in sight, and the flares had disappeared. Without speaking, they pushed the machine safely into the hangar.
"Well, fix up quarters here in the hangar," said Biggles. "Then the machine will always be in sight. Now, I'm hungry. Wilkes, where'd you get your food supplies?"
Down in the village. There's only one place you can get grub, the Three-Star Saloon."
"Then Ginger and I'll go down and lay in a stock. Will you be all right here on your own?"
"Oh, why not?" replied Wilkes. I had to handle things by myself for some time now."
It was a walk of about 2 miles to the cluster of log huts that formed the village of Fort Beaver. There was no mistaking the Three-Star Saloon, for three lanterns hung at regular intervals along the front, enabling the sign to be read. Biggles pushed open the door, and a loud buzz of conversation met his ears. The saloon was lit by several smoky paraffin lamps, around which eddied a mist of rank tobacco smoke.
"Give it a name, strangers," said the barman.
While Ginger ordered a couple of drinks, Biggles took an old envelope from his pocket and started jotting down selected items from the goods he saw exposed for sale. Bread, biscuits, coffee, beans, and the like. Several men, trappers or prospectors, judging from their clothes, were seated nearby, engaged in conversation. But Biggles paid them no attention until a name caught his ears. The name was Wilkinson, pronounced Wilkson by the man who had uttered it. He was an old man and was dressed in the traditional fur jacket of a prospector. Around his neck was wound a white-spotted red scarf, held together incongruously with a distinctive opal-headed tie-pin.
"Yep, just my partner Angus Stirling to think of something for me to do,"
continued the old man in a wheezy voice, as Biggles regarded him with sudden interest.
"I'm pulling out tomorrow, and I near forgot. If you see that fellow Wilkson," says Angus, "tell him I forgot to give him that land transfer. But I still got it. Now I guess I've got to trail across to that pesky aerodrome."
Biggles butted in. "Excuse me. You're Angus Stirling's partner?"
Sure am, stranger. Mose is my name. Me and Angus is working a claim on Eskimo Island."
"I'm a friend of Captain Wilkinson. Is it correct that Angus asked you to tell Wilkinson that he still has the transfer of the land he sold him?"
That's right enough."
"I'm glad to hear it," Biggles continued. "We need that paper badly. How far away is this Eskimo Island?"
About 1,500 miles due north, I guess. I'm going back there tomorrow."
"'I'm flying north to Moose Creek tomorrow,' said Biggles. "'If you care to come along, it should save you some time. "'Maybe we could go right on to your claim.'
"'A childish grin spread slowly over the old man's face.
"'You mean you'd take me up in an aeroplane?'
"'That's right.
"'Will it be room for the grub?'
Mose inquired.
"'I've a fair load, enough to last me and Angus through the freeze-up.'
"'You can take anything up to a ton,' returned Biggles.
"'Oh, well, I ain't got that much. "'Mister, you got a deal.'
"'Be at the aerodrome, then, at the crack of dawn. "'See you in the morning.'
Biggles settled the bill, and subconsciously aware that a curious silence had fallen on the room, reached for his drink. Simultaneously, there was a deafening roar, and the glass burst into smithereens. For a moment, Biggles stared with startled eyes at the spot where his glass had been. Then, recovering quickly, he looked around. At the far end of the bar stood McBain, a bottle of whiskey in one hand, and a smoking revolver in the other. No one spoke. The only sound in the room was the soft shuffle of feet as the other men in the bar began to back away out of the line of fire. Unhurriedly, Biggles turned a reflective eye on McBain, who was now holding a glass in one hand, while the revolver, an almost imperceptible coil of smoke creeping from the muzzle, and the bottle of whiskey rested on the bar in front of him.
"Give me another drink, boss, will you?"
requested Biggles quietly, and put his hand in his pocket as if to take out the money to pay for it. McBain stood his glass on the bar. His hand moved towards the revolver, but on this occasion things did not go in accordance with his plan. Biggles' hand jerked out of his pocket. There was a double report, the two shots coming so close together they almost sounded like one. There was a crash of shattering glass, and a metallic ping as McBain's bottle of whiskey splintered into 100 pieces, and his revolver spun along the polished bar before falling behind it.
"'What's the matter, McBain?' asked Biggles evenly. "'Any fool can play a game single-handed. "'You don't mind me joining in, surely?'
Biggles addressed the barkeeper.
"'What is the usual procedure in a case like this, in this part of the world?' he inquired. "'Do I shoot him?'
"'Hey, wait a minute,' snapped the bartender. "'I don't want no shooting here.'
"'I didn't start it,' Biggles pointed out.
"'No, I know you didn't.'
"'I'd better plug him and rid the world of a dirty beast,' suggested Biggles,
wondering at the back of his mind why McBain's friends did not take a hand. Snatching a glance in their direction, he understood. Ginger's automatic was covering them. How the matter would have ended, it's impossible to say, but at that moment the outside door was flung open, and Delaney the police constable stood on the threshold, a carbine in his hands.
"'What's the shooting?'
inquired bluntly.
"'Only me and McBain, seeing who can spill most liquor,' replied Biggles.
"'You two at it again?'
The constable's eyes went from one to the other.
"'Who pulled first?' he demanded.
"'McBain! He shot his drink!'
shouted old Mose shrilly.
"'I've seen it!'
"'Any more shooting between you two, and I'll throw you both in jail,' declared the constable.
"'Quite right,' murmured Biggles, putting his automatic back in his pocket. "'Come on, Ginger, grab their supplies, and let's be going.'
As they went out, Biggles nodded to Mose. "'See you at daybreak,' he called. Then the door closed behind them, and they hurried back to the aerodrome. On their return to the hangar, Biggles reported the shooting incident in full to Wilkes. "'But what's more important,' he continued quickly, "'we've got on the track of Angus Stirling. "'He's working a claim up north on Eskimo Island with an old fellow named Mose. "'Mose is here in Fort Beaver collecting winter stores, "'and Angus sent a message to you to the effect that he's got the land transfer. "'You can have it when you want.' Wilkes sprang to his feet.
"'Oh, is that in our possession? We can give McBain his marching orders.'
Biggles nodded.
"'That's the way I see it.
So I've arranged to fly Mose back to the claim tomorrow. We'll land first at Moose Creek, where I'll dump the freight for the gold people. Mose will meet us here at dawn.' A shadow of anxiety crossed Wilkes's face.
"'You said McBain was there,' he muttered. "'If he knows about this, he may try to stop Mose.'
"'Well, I think he knows, but I don't see what he can do,' answered Biggles thoughtfully. "'Anyway, all we want tomorrow is a fine day. "'Algie and Smith should be back with the other machine, "'and the next day we should be back with the transfer.
Then we'll see what McBain has to say. I wonder what the weather's doing. I'll go and have a look, offered Ginger, and leaving the table, walked slowly out of the hangar door. 20 minutes later, Ginger had not returned. The others were just starting out to look for him when suddenly he burst through the door.
Where the dickens have you been? Snapped Biggles tersely.
Ginger's manner was abrupt as he waved them back to the table.
I've been indulging in a very questionable pastime. Some people might call it eavesdropping, but in time of war like this, the best people call it scouting. I've been listening in at McBain's hut across the field. McBain himself wasn't there at first, but he arrived later, looking somewhat agitated, I may add. But Wilkes, if you think those guys are here simply to run you off your aerodrome, you're wrong.
There was a moment's silence.
What are they after?
Biggles almost hissed the words. Ginger drained a cup of cold coffee before replying.
Gold, he said quickly. The little bags of yellow metal from Moose Creek.
Wilkes nodded slowly.
Oh, kick me, somebody, he said weakly. I never even thought of that.
The stars were still twinkling in the sky when, the following morning, Biggles, Wilkes and Ginger pulled the Jupiter out of the shed. While they were waiting for Mose, they discussed the new aspect of Ginger's scouting expedition the previous night.
It would be no use telling Delaney without proof, remarked Biggles quietly. He'd think that we were just shooting a cock-and-bull story to put McBain & Co. under suspicion.
How about warning the people at Moose Creek, suggested Wilkes.
They'd be less likely to believe us than Delaney, declared Biggles. They would think it a scheme to put McBain out of the airline business. They might even tell McBain we'd reported them as crooks. Then we'd never be able to expose him. No. At this juncture, we say nothing to anybody.
Biggles glanced at his wristwatch as he finished speaking.
Oh, Mose is late, he observed.
Who's this coming? Asked Ginger,
staring in the direction of the village. Looks like Delaney. Yes, it is him, declared Biggles.
A minute later, the Mountie pulled up his horse and dismounted beside the waiting airman. His eyes rested on Biggles' face.
Where did you go after you left the 3-star last night? He asked crisply.
Biggles raised his eyebrows.
Ginger and I came straight back here.
Wilkes can verify when we got back.
What's this all about, anyway?
What were you three standing here for when I came along? You looked as if you were expecting somebody.
We were, agreed Biggles. We'd arranged to fly Angus Sterling's partner, Mose, back to their claim.
Between ourselves, Delaney, Angus has got the transfer for this property. If we get it, we can give McBain the run-along.
Well, Mose won't be coming, said the constable slowly.
He's dead.
Biggles paled.
Dead? He cried incredulously. Why, he was as right as rain last night.
No doubt he would have been this morning, too. Someone hadn't clubbed his brains out.
You mean he was murdered?
People don't beat their own brains out.
Biggles' mind raced as he tried to focus the situation in its new aspect.
Well, we have nothing to gain by his death, he pointed out.
We want that transfer badly.
My gosh, things look bad for Angus. Mose was taking up their winter grub.
If Angus is somewhere on Eskimo Island, he'll be snowed in for 6 months come to freeze up.
He'll starve, said Delaney.
I'll take the grub up, stated Biggles.
Then you've no time to waste, said Delaney harshly. The snow's on the way, but why don't you stay here, in case I want you. I'll go and have a word with McBain.
With a curt nod, the constable led his horse towards McBain's shed, where McBain himself and his crew were now pulling an aeroplane from the hangar. As soon as Delaney was out of earshot, Ginger swung round to Biggles.
McBain must have killed him, he whispered tensely. Remember, last night. I told you he came in when I was eavesdropping, very late and very agitated. He must have done it.
I wonder, murmured Biggles. Well, if he did, he certainly had a motive. By killing the old man, he might have reckoned on stopping us making contact with Angus.
Question is, does McBain know that we know Angus is on Eskimo Island?
There's no use guessing, anyway. The first thing we've got to do is get poor old Moses Grubstake up here. Then to Angus, if we can find him.
The business of fetching Angus's winter supplies occupied some time, for it meant a journey to the village. By the time Biggles and Ginger got back to the aerodrome, Delaney had gone. So had one of McBain's Wankel 12 transports.
It took off about 20 minutes ago,
explained Wilkes. "Headed north, with Sarton flying and Chico alongside."
Biggles nodded, and climbed into the cabin of the Jupiter. En route to Moose Creek, Biggles roared low over Wilkes's rockheed, but receiving an okay signal from Algy, he did not land. Biggles tilted the Jupiter's nose upwards as he climbed to his original height and settled down for the long journey to Moose Creek. The sun was hanging low over the western mountains when Biggles saw what he knew must be the goldfield. On the banks of a wide creek were clustered a number of huts with corrugated iron roofs. Near them, the ground was flat, and as they glided down, they were able to discern wheel tracks, indicating where machines usually landed. The place could hardly be called an aerodrome. In 10 minutes, they had taxied up to the buildings, where a man in a fur jacket was waiting for them. "Are you Canwell?" called Biggles, guessing it was the traffic manager.
"Well, you said it," was the curt reply. "You seen anything of Wilkinson?"
"Yes, I'm his new partner. I've brought your stuff along."
"Oh, about time, too."
"We had some trouble, but we're all set now for regular service," Biggles promised him. Canwell blew a whistle, at which some men appeared and began unloading the equipment.
"I've just had one of McBean's machines here," he told Biggles.
It struck Biggles as odd that they hadn't seen the Winkle on its homeward journey, but he didn't comment on it.
"What did they want, sir?" he inquired.
"They offered to carry all my stuff at 15 cents a pound."
Biggles was taken aback at this cut rate, but his face remained expressionless.
"I'll do it at 12 cents.
"Sounds fair to me," said Canwell. "I aim to have a shipment box ready for tomorrow, so you can take it. You'll be staying here tonight?"
Biggles looked at the sun.
"Well, how much daylight have I got left?"
"Huh.
About a week to 10 days, I reckon."
Enlightenment burst upon Biggles. He realized they were so far north that the sun did not drop below the horizon until it went for good in the long winter months.
"Of course, the midnight sun," he exclaimed.
"How far is it to Eskimo Island?"
"Oh, about 500 miles due north."
"Good. We can make it there and back in time."
Canwell's eyes narrowed.
"Whatever happens, that metal has got to go to Fort Beaver tomorrow."
"You mean if I'm not here, then McBain takes it?"
"That's precisely what I mean. See you tomorrow."
Biggles and Ginger climbed into their seats to resume the flight northward. "The thing that beats me," muttered Biggles as he started the engines, "is how Sarton got back without us seeing him." "He might have gone on to where we're going," suggested Ginger. Biggles started.
"Gosh, I never thought of that."
A minute or two later, the big machine was nosing up in the sky, which had taken on a dull, leaden hue.
"Look at that," remarked Biggles. "It's going to snow before long, and when it starts, it'll snow for a long, long time."
Ginger shivered suddenly, conscious of a terrifying solitude. He was about to remark on this to Biggles, when a sound reached his ears that caused every muscle in his body to stiffen. He knew what it was immediately. It was the unmistakable rattle of a machine gun. Before he could even move, the sound came again, this time much more distinctly, and simultaneously the Jupiter quivered as if it had been struck by a cat of nine tails. Ginger's throat turned dry, and the next instant he was clinging desperately to his seat as the Jupiter soared upwards in a wild, climbing turn. Bracing himself against the side of the cabin, he looked out of the window, just in time to see a Winkle transport go tearing past. The window nearest to him was open, and from it projected what appeared to be a short black stick, at the end of which danced a vicious streak of flame.
"Use the signal pistol! It's all we've got!"
Biggles' voice was like cracking ice. His face was white and his eyes glittered curiously.
"I'll try to put you in a position for a shot. If you can hit them, it may set them alight. You might hit a prop."
A signal pistol against a machine gun? Even Ginger was experienced enough to know the odds were nearly hopeless.
"Need we stop and fight?" he asked tersely. "They've got the legs of us by 10 miles an hour, was the curt reply. "Use the pistol!"
Ginger snatched the large bored pistol from its pocket and thrust a thick cartridge into its breech. There was only one cartridge remaining, and this he pushed into his pocket. "I'm going outside," he said tersely. "Well, hang on tight. I may have to throw the machine about." Another moment, and Ginger had flung back the emergency trap in the roof and was climbing halfway out. The icy blast of the slipstream smote his face and tore at his body, and he knew that he would not be able to endure the exposure for long without becoming frozen. He looked around and saw the attacking machine on the opposite side of a narrow circle, round which both aircraft were racing. Ginger flinched as he heard a burst of bullets strike the Jupiter somewhere near the tail. In the next few minutes, Biggles twice took the big machine into position for a shot, but each time the tearing slipstream spoiled Ginger's aim. He had only two cartridges, and determined to make the most of them. His first chance came when Biggles whirled like lightning and tore straight under the Winkel, so close that Ginger instinctively ducked. He fired straight up. The resultant ball of green fire went slap through the fabric, making a neat hole which did not affect the Winkel's performance. With the tears that the icy blast forced from his eyes freezing on his cheeks, he thrust the last cartridge into the breech. He had to put the pistol into his pocket and hang on with both hands, while Biggles did an Immelmann turn. But he grabbed the weapon again as the Jupiter came out in the position this manoeuvre is designed to effect, on the tail of the opposing machine. Ginger clenched his teeth, and taking deliberate aim, fired. To his dismay, the cartridge misfired. He fired again. Once more, the expected report failed to occur. By this time, the Jupiter was almost immediately above the Winkel and fast overhauling it. Ginger did the only thing left for him to do. He flung the now useless pistol. At the same moment, Biggles dragged the Jupiter away, and Ginger, half dead with cold, slid back into the cabin.
"Missed!" he shouted to Biggles. "No more cartridges. But can you put us in that position again? I've just had an idea."
Biggles merely nodded. He did not seem in the least perturbed. Ginger staggered back into the main cabin, from where he returned an instant later, carrying a foot-square box, branded with bold black letters, £20 corned beef, stow away from engines. Not without difficulty, Ginger dragged this unwieldy weapon up into his recently held position. Biggles had already begun the Immelmann, which starts with a steep climbing turn, so it seemed to Ginger that the world was spinning with a dizzy speed. Raising himself on one knee, he waited while the two machines closed up as though drawn by an invisible magnet. Twice he heard the crack of a bullet boring through the Jupiter. Then, as they swooped low over the Winkel, he flung the heavy box outwards and downwards with all his force. His eyes never left the box, and he followed its course with a morbid fascination. The box struck the Winkel's wing about 4 feet from the tip, causing the whole wingtip to crumple up like tissue paper. For a second or two, the plane zoomed this way and that, and an instant later, the Winkel was spinning earthward. In fascinated horror, Ginger watched it go. He saw the damaged wing balloon and rip off at the roots. He saw the fuselage spin faster and faster, saw the French Canadian flung out and go plunging down, clutching vainly at air. The Winkel hit the snow and crumpled into 1,000 fragments. A great pillar of fire leapt heavenwards. White-faced, he fell back weakly into the cabin. Biggles turned an expressionless face towards him.
"They got what they asked for," he said grimly.
"Good work, laddie. You find some hot coffee in the thermos. You look as if you need it."
For some minutes, neither of them spoke. Ginger gulped the hot coffee and began a vigorous massage of his face and hands to restore circulation. He had not expected any great praise from Biggles for what he had done, which didn't mean that Biggles didn't appreciate it. Biggles himself did whatever circumstances demanded. Algy the same. At last Biggles spoke.
"We'd better start looking out for Eskimo Island," he observed. "But how on earth we're going to tell where it is, I'm dashed if I know. Everything's frozen, and some snow must have fallen too. We can't tell which is land and which is water. So keep a sharp look..."
Biggles broke off abruptly as the port engine spluttered, picked up, and spluttered again. Suddenly it cut out, dead. A horrid suspicion flashed into Ginger's mind. Looking back into the main cabin, his face turned ashen.
"It's petrol," he cried. "It's slopping everywhere. The main tank must be holed."
Even as he spoke, the second engine died out. A weird silence fell, broken only by the faint whine of the wind over the wings. Biggles flattened out to land, with a feeling that the dead flat white surface looked almost too good to be true. But nothing untoward happened, and the wheels ran through the snow with a gentle hissing sound. Then, very slowly, in the still, twilight air, the machine came to rest. For a while, neither of them spoke. Cold was intense. Ginger shivered.
"Well,"
he said,
"what do we do next?"
"But to tell the truth, laddie, I was just wondering," replied Biggles. "As I see it, we've got two fairly sound chances. The first is that Algy and Wilkes will come to look for us in the Rockheed, and the second is that we shall see or hear something of Angus. He must be somewhere near Eskimo Island."
"That's true enough," acknowledged Ginger. "Gosh, it's..."
He broke off suddenly, staring at the sky.
"Why, look, there's a searchlight," he cried. "Must be Algy. There's another, three, four. Why, there's a dozen. What the dickens is going on?"
Biggles laughed.
"I should say it's the Aurora Borealis."
Ginger nodded.
"Oh, of course, the Northern Lights.
My goodness. Look how the colours change."
"But that isn't the Aurora Borealis," he cried emphatically, pointing in the direction of a distant ridge.
"That's yellow lamplight."
"Where?"
"That's funny. It's gone now," said Ginger in a puzzled voice. "You see those two peaks? It seemed to be at the foot of those. I'm absolutely certain."
All right, I'll take your word for it," said Biggles. "If you're right, it could only be Angus. Those peaks must be Eskimo Island. What a stroke of luck."
It took Biggles and Ginger 3 hours of long, hard slog before they reached their objective. Biggles eyed the peaks with disfavour. All around was a land of death, as devoid of life as the earth must once have been. He looked ahead at a tiny object, floating feather-like in the still air. "Snow," he said grimly. "We'd better find Angus pretty soon, or else." Biggles put his hand into his pocket and took out his automatic. Pointing the muzzle in the air, he fired 3 times at regular intervals. Ginger flinched as the shots crashed out like a salvo of artillery.
"Gosh,"
he murmured in an awestruck voice, as the echoes finally rolled away.
"If Angus is within 50 miles, he'll hear that."
Biggles smiled.
"Yeah, a little hectic, wasn't it?"
They set off again, following the foot of the peaks, pausing from time to time to listen and rest. They had covered perhaps 100 yards this way, with big flakes of snow falling regularly, when Ginger suddenly pulled up short.
"There's something moving up ahead," he said quietly.
"Stand fast," came the swift answer. "It's a polar bear. Gosh, what a monster!"
The bear, an enormous shaggy brute that looked grey in the half-light, saw them. Instantly it raised itself on its hind legs and let out a deep, snarling growl.
"Look out, it's coming!" jerked out Biggles. "Don't run! Wait till he gets close and make every shot count!"
With his heart hammering against his ribs, Ginger whipped out his automatic and waited as the great beast came on. At a distance of 5 or 6 yards, Biggles fired. But it did nothing to stop the beast's berserk progress. Biggles blazed point-blank at the pointed head. Then, in his haste to step aside, he slipped and measured his length in the snow. In a flash, the bear was over him. Ginger's one conscious thought was that he must save Biggles. Hardly knowing what he was doing, he rushed up to the bear. The next instant, a huge, hairy paw caught him a sweeping blow on the shoulder, and he went over backwards. A sickening stench of bear filled his nostrils. A roaring, crashing report almost deafened him. Then a great weight settled on his body, crushing the life out of him. Something seized him by the arm, and he screamed, thinking it was the bear's huge jaws. Then the scene seemed to change, and he found himself on his feet, panting and muttering incoherently.
"Och, now, take it easy,"
said a strange voice in a strong Scots accent. Ginger stared at a short, broad-shouldered figure with a smoking rifle in the crook of its arm. Suddenly he understood.
"You're Angus Stirling," he blurted out.
It was not far to the old Scotsman's cabin.
"I've got some bad news for you, Angus," Biggles said grimly. "Mose won't be coming back."
"Aye, that means he's dead."
Biggles nodded. "Quite right. He was murdered." And he told Angus the whole story, how they heard Mose inquiring for Wilkes and the events that followed. When he had finished, the old man stared at the fire in silence.
"Aye,
Poor old Mose, he said at last. I know, Brindle. It's bad medicine. It was mighty kind of you to come up here, mister. But here you'll stay, I reckon. And since you're liable to be stopping, I'll tell you something.
Mose was a rich man. Aye, me and Mose struck it rich.
Biggles looked surprised.
You mean you found gold?
Aye, man.
Mose had a tidy poke here.
Though a part of good it'll do him now. Well, for us it all depends on the weather.
Angus crossed to the door and flung it open. Outside it was no longer snowing, and the world lay still and white under a cold blue dome.
This looks like a chance to bring the grub up from your aeroplane.
Yeah, it's a bit of luck with snow holding off like this.
If it starts again, your plane will be buried before long.
Got to make the most of it.
By the time they arrived at the Jupiter, Ginger had lost all count of time. Not that it really mattered now. In future, the weather would rule their actions and not the clock. Vaguely he wondered what Algy and Wilkes were doing. But once the snow started again, it would put an end to any idea of rescue. He thought no more about it, but set to work with the others unloading the stores. This done, he was about to suggest to Biggles that they drain off the Jupiter's oil, when he heard the distant hum of an aeroplane. The sound was unmistakable, and his heart leapt.
"Good old Algy!"
he shouted gleefully.
"There he is," declared Biggles, pointing at a black speck that had materialized out of the dull haze concealing the southern horizon. "He's seen us," went on Biggles joyfully. "I saw him turn. He's coming."
And then his voice died away in a curious manner. Ginger, staring at the fast-approaching machine, knew why. It was not Wilkes's Rockheed. It was McBain's second Winkle that was roaring low towards them. To say that Ginger was flabbergasted would be to express his feelings mildly. He was thunderstruck. The possibility of this development had not occurred to him. Ginger turned to Biggles, who was staring at the oncoming machine with disgust.
"He was looking for Sarton, I expect," he muttered.
Biggles nodded.
"He spotted who we are," he said bitterly. "It'd be interesting to see what he does."
The Winkle banked sharply and, putting its nose down, dived at the stranded Jupiter. Biggles let out a warning yell.
"Lie flat!"
Above the bellow of the Winkle's engines, there came the vicious chatter of a machine gun, and a line of ice splinters and flecks of snow leapt into the air. As it swept past, Ginger clearly saw McBain himself behind the gun, which was thrust through a side window of the control cabin.
"Dig down!" shouted Biggles, seeing that the Winkle was coming back.
This time, as the Winkle hurtled past, the gun was silent. Instead, a small square object crashed down near the Jupiter, bouncing over and over again. A signal light shot from the Winkle, cutting a flaming line through the air, and struck the snow near the object. A sheet of flame leapt upwards.
"It's petrol," yelled Biggles. "He's trying to burn the Jupiter!"
2 gallons of petrol make a considerable flame, and the whole scene was bathed in a lurid glow. But it was soon clear that in this case the Jupiter would not be damaged. Owing to the snow, the petrol did not spread far, and the flame was 10 yards from the machine. For the next few seconds, the movements of the Winkle puzzled the watchers on the ground. The plane turned away sharply and began climbing steeply.
"I think he's going," said Biggles, rising to his feet.
"No, that isn't it," cried Ginger.
"Look!"
Biggles followed the direction indicated. What he saw made him catch his breath sharply.
"It's Algy," he muttered hoarsely.
Heading straight towards the scene was a Rockheed freighter, attracted, no doubt, by the signal flare and fire.
"I don't think Algy's seen the Winkle," muttered Ginger in a hopeless voice. "He's probably got his eyes fixed on us," returned Biggles tersely. Helpless, they could only stand and watch.
The Winkle climbed straight up under the tail of the Rockheed, which was gliding down slowly, looking for a place to land. An arm appeared out of the window, waving, making it obvious that those inside had not the slightest suspicion of danger. The watchers on the ground saw the whole thing clearly. They saw McBain take slow and careful aim. saw the jabbing tongues of flame dance from the muzzle, saw the Rockheed shiver as the burst of fire hit her. The Rockheed dropped the port wing, stalled, came out again, and stalled again, obviously out of control. Then, as if by a miracle, the machine righted itself and turned sluggishly towards them. The reason for this apparent miracle became revealed. Algy was out on the starboard wing, lying flat and clinging to the leading edge, in an attempt to counterbalance the sagging port wing. The Rockheed swept down like a tired bird. The port wing tip sagged again and touched the ground momentarily. The whole machine cartwheeled, flinging Algy over and over across the snow. The fuselage tipped up, hanging poised for a moment, then fell back. Movement ceased. The Winkle, its engines roaring triumphantly, swept up into the sky and levelled out, its nose pointing south. Neither Biggles or Ginger paid it any attention, as they raced towards the crash machine. "Get Algy! I'll look after Wilkes!" yelled Biggles. His great fear was that the machine would go up in flames. He tore open the cabin door and disappeared inside. Ginger went on to Algy. "Algy, old man, are you badly hurt?" Algy managed to get up on his hands and knees.
"I'm only winded," he stammered.
"Gosh, how's Wilkes? Is he hurt?" By now Biggles had managed to get Wilkes out of the wreckage. He was sitting nearby, very pale, while Biggles mopped blood from a cut in his forehead. Angus was winding a bandage tightly round his left wrist, which he had sprained slightly. "How's Algy?" Biggles asked as Ginger ran over. "Oh, not bad, apart from being winded." "The snow probably broke his fall," returned Biggles shortly. Algy, his back slightly bent, came limping over to them. "I've had enough of this farthest north stuff. Do you see that skunk McBain shoot us down?" he said bitterly. "He was having it at us when you arrived." "Did he shoot you down too?" asked Algy. "No, Sarton was responsible for that. He's down. Dead. And Chico with him." Briefly, Biggles described all that had transpired since he had left Algy and Smith to repair the damaged Rockheed.
"Well, what are we going to do now?"
asked Wilkes when Biggles had finished recounting his story.
"Looks like we're here for the winter."
"I'm not so sure about that," put in Biggles. "We may have a chance yet. Have you plenty of juice in your tanks?"
50 gallons, I reckon."
Biggles grinned. "Then if we mend the hole in our tank and swap the petrol over, we can get back in the Jupiter. We've got a pair of landing skis inside. If we jack up the undercart and put the skis on, we might still do it, if the snow holds off a little longer." Algy sprang to his feet, his stiffness forgotten. "Let's get at it," he cried. "It's our only chance." "Find that bullet hole, Ginger," Biggles ordered. "It's a race against time now." For 3 hours, the airman and Angus worked feverishly, being impeded to no small extent by the cold. Ginger repaired the punctured tank, bemoaning the fact that Smith, an expert metal worker, was not there to help him. Algy explained that he had left Smith at Fort Beaver when they had arrived, as arranged, in the Rockheed. He was guarding the sheds. At long last it was done, and the transformation of the Jupiter into an airworthy ski plane was complete. "Is there anything at the cabin you'll be wanting?" Biggles asked Angus. "I take it you'll be coming with us."
"Oh, no, man. I'm staying here."
Biggles shrugged his shoulders. "All right, you know best what you want to do. We'll taxi you and your stores back to the shack and pick up the transfer. We'll get away before it starts to snow." Angus cocked an eye heavenward and saw one or two big flakes floating downward languidly. "Eh, no time to waste," he observed dispassionately. "Here she comes." It took them some time to start the cold engines, but a little petrol inserted in the cylinders finally did the trick, and the Jupiter began gliding across the snow towards the cabin. By the time Angus's stores were thrown out, the old man had returned from the shack with the precious transfer and a small sack. "What's that?" yelled Biggles.
"Old Moses Polk! Gold!" shouted Angus. "He's got a daughter down in Vancouver. Will you find her and give it to her?"
"All right," shouted Biggles. "Stand clear."
A parting wave to the old Scotsman, and the Jupiter swung round and raced across the snow. A moment later it rose slowly into the air, heading south for Moose Creek. Within 10 minutes the snow began to thin, and they caught their first sight of the ground. Shortly afterwards they ran into clear weather, although the landscape was still snow-covered.
"Pity we've lost the Rockheed," Biggles remarked. "That leaves us only the one machine."
Well, never mind. We've got the transfer, Wilkes reminded him.
By the way, what are we going to do about McBain?